You're listening to the Food Talk Show on channelradio.co.uk. It's the Food Talk Show with me, Paul Andrews, and the lovely Sue Nelson. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, that's better.
It's a bit difficult because we're in this new studio and don't know which buttons to push.
I know.
Sorry about that.
I know.
I've got the right buttons to push now. We've got a great show as usual.
We have, but we are virgins here, aren't we?
I just love it in here because it's all like electronic-y, where the other studios are great. As you know, everybody loves the other studios we've got, and we've still got those for our music shows. But I like being in here. It's funky and modern and high-tech, and that's how it should be.
It's brilliant, isn't it? It's a lovely studio, and if only I could work out how to use it, it would be really brilliant.
I'm sure we'll be fine.
But we're going okay so far, but this is the first show ever broadcast from Channel Radio's Ashford studio. So thank you all for listening in and being part of that experience. And we've got a food talk show for you.
We have. So I've got Graham Barber of Woodchurch Wine, and funny enough, I bought some of his wine the other week, just by coincidence, and God, it tastes amazing. So we're going to talk to Graham about having vineyards in Kent, which is a real interesting topic at the moment. And then I've got Emma Rothwell of Foodminder, and as we know, food waste is a. What are you doing with that, Paul? You're experimenting, aren't you, with your new buttons? So we've got Emma Rothwell, a Foodminder, and we're going to talk about, again, a very topical subject, which is about food waste. And she's come up with some great ideas about how we minimise food waste. So I'm looking forward to that. And then, of course, we've got our I Hate Heston spot, which is about a great recipe and a great snack, mushrooms on toast. Sort of thing you do, Paul?
Mushrooms on toast is exactly the kind of thing I'd do, Sue. It's one of those snacky things that you have, isn't it?
It's very comforting, like mashed potato or pie or something like that. So it was one of the guys that we met when we were at the NEC in Birmingham for the Food and Drink Expo. And he was just doing this lovely recipe, nice and easy, which is what we like, but tastes fantastic. So we'll be having that later on. Do you want to know a little bit about sparkling wine in Kent first?
About what?
Sparkling wine in Kent. We're not really allowed to call it champagne. I'm sure Graham will tell us.
See, that's what threw me. Sparkling
wine. Well, you're not really allowed to call it champagne unless it's grown in the Champagne region. But it is, for all intents and purposes, it is champagne. Well, I'm sure Graham will tell us later, but it is. Did you know that great sparkling wine and champagne usually use three grapes? Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. And a lot of people say, oh, I don't like Chardonnay. And you think, well, you drink champagne, so you can't be that adverse to Chardonnay. And you like Chablis, so you can't be that adverse to Chardonnay. And you like Bordeaux, so you can't be that adverse to Chardonnay. So a lot of Chardonnay in sparkling wine, champagne, and Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier.
Well, you did throw me at first when you said there was only three grapes, because I didn't think that would go very far.
No, didn't quite mean that. I mean three varieties of grapes.
Oh, I see. Not being someone of the drinking persuasion, I wasn't too sure.
No, well, you don't really know much about alcohol, do you?
I know nothing about
And of course, I know a lot.
Which is one of the fascinations of this show, because I learn about things I know nothing about. And there's not much I know nothing about. Oh, yes, there is.
I would disagree with that. You'll have also read that Tattinger is the first French champagne house to produce fizz in the UK, after they invested in a former Kent apple orchard.
Right.
So the French are coming over. And the Tattinger sort of company and their investors has bought 180 acres of farmland near Chilham, which is near Canterbury. Mm. And they expect to fill their first bottles in the next 4 to 5 years. So I'm quite interested to see how a brand, Tattinger, which is French, is then going to market something that's grown in England, and whether they're allowed to call it champagne or not.
I was just going to say that. Does that mean they're not allowed to call it champagne anymore now that it's in England?
Sure.
It's interesting, that, isn't it? We'll see how that pans out. I can't imagine that they would wear that, to be honest.
And the total production of English wine reached 6.3 million bottles in 2014.
Wow.
And Waitrose reported record Christmas sales, up 188%. So this is English sparkling wine. Mm. And Marks and Spencer's also revealed 300% increase in sales of Chapel Down English sparkling brut, which again is another Kent-based vineyard.
Absolutely.
So I think what's interesting is that people aren't being snobby about champagne at all. That they're beginning to realise that English sparkling wine is of phenomenal quality, and they're winning lots of blind tasting awards over in France, which is really interesting. And I'm sure that's because of the soil that we've got and the change in our weather.
Absolutely. I mean, maybe we can discuss this with Graham later, but do you think it's because British wine drinkers of any kind have become slightly more sophisticated now? You know, over the years, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, a bottle of Lee Frail Milch, a bit of Blue Nun was pushing the boat out, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Or Pease Porter, I seem to remember that one.
Yeah, exactly. And do you think it's because we've become less enamoured by labels and are more inclined to go on taste and quality of the wine? So therefore, we'll drink things that we enjoy rather than just for the sake of the region it came from or whatever.
I think the supermarkets have played a very big role in wine sales. I also find that when I go abroad, you know, when I go to France or Spain or Portugal, I tend to only be able to get French wine in France and Spanish wine in Spain. Whereas because we haven't had a huge tradition of winemaking, when I go into an English supermarket, you know, we can get wine from nearly every, you know, wine producing country in the world. And I think that's sure. I think that's educated people quite a lot and helped them to experiment as well. So I think we're not so frightened of trying things that are new, and maybe that's helped.
Yeah, absolutely.
What should we do next? Should we have a bit of music, and then I'm really excited to talk to Graham.
Are you?
Mm.
Do you want to start to talk to Graham for a little bit?
It's because you're worried about your knobs. You
No. It's just that I've got some cheesy tunage that I was going to play, and I don't mind. I can play that after Graham's had a little word. What do you reckon?
Okay, that's fine. Well, yeah. Graham Barber is of Woodchurch Wine, and if anybody wants to find out about Woodchurch Wine, they just need to go on woodchurchwine.co.uk. He runs a family business that produces sparkling wine, which was set up in 2009, and they released their first wines just last year. And actually, Woodchurch is very close to the studio. It's in the middle of Kent, and I believe he manages the vines by hand, and he has a state-of-the-art winery. Hello, Graham.
Good afternoon.
What a terrible job that you have, wandering around your vineyard producing sparkling wine.
It could be worse.
Could be worse. Where on earth did you get this idea to do this? And what was your background that made you think, I'm going to go for this?
Well, my background is actually in publishing. Spent many years working in publishing in London.
Right.
And it's a bit of a cliche, I know, but obviously looking for to do something different for many years. I had a big interest in wine. But then I met my wife, who is my wife now, and she similarly...
Your current wife.
My current wife.
Your first wife.
Yeah, the present Mrs. Barber.
Yeah.
And she had a similar interest, and the two of us, you know, just started talking about it, and we thought, well, why don't we do it? Let's just try and do...
You've only got one life, so if we think we're going to do it, why don't we just make the leap?
Yeah.
So when you say we're going to do it, blimey, what does that entail in terms of... What do you do? First thing, you go and look for some land or find a winemaker for you? Or what was the first step?
The first step was to find some land. Exactly right. Mm. Yes. We had a certain amount of money. We had a certain idea of how much we wanted. And then we had to find the land to fit the bill. And it took a long time to find the right piece of land.
And where you found the land, is that somewhere where you were local to already? Or did you move a long way?
Well, I've always lived in Kent, and one of the ideas I had before starting the vineyard was to do something based in Kent.
Right.
I've been a big believer in Kent produce, in local produce, and read a lot about English wine, and as Sue's just been talking about, the fact that we could now make good wine in the south of England was one of the reasons I wanted to start the business. So I was always looking in Kent. I didn't actually know the village at Woodchurch before we found the piece of land.
It's a lovely village, but it's a lovely green, and it's a nice village to be in.
It's a beautiful part of Kent, and Kent's a beautiful county, and so it's wonderful to be there.
And do you have to look for specific soil? So I know that the sort of chalky soil seems to be good for the champagne region. So you can't just go, well, I'll buy this land over here. It used to be a lorry park or something. What's your criteria for looking for some land?
Well, there's all sorts of criteria. The soil is definitely one of the criteria. It doesn't have to be chalky. Lots of parts of Champagne aren't actually chalky.
Okay.
Or they don't really talk about that too much in Champagne, but they aren't. More importantly is the aspect. It has to be south-facing, ideally is south-facing. It has to be the right sort of size and shape according to your budget. And it has to have the right climate as well. Mm. So, and, you know, not too high, not too low, that type of thing.
And Kent's sort of climate seems to have changed. I mean, you know, without getting into the debate about global warming, I mean, for sure, you know, our weather is different than it used to be. And I hear that we had a stonking year last year in terms of weather, whereas the French weather was really very wet. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that this is the place to be if you're going to be doing sparkling wine? Because the weather pattern here is ideal for that slightly cooler, you know, that produces great sparkling wine as opposed to, you know, the sort of white wines or the heavy red wines. Our weather at the moment is really suiting sparkling wine. Is that true?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the recent surge in sparkling English wine is predicated upon climate change. I mean, 30 years ago, you wouldn't be able to make the wine that we are able to make now. And in 30 years' time, we'll have to make slightly different wine again.
We'll be moving up to Birmingham to grow our vines.
We will. That's really fascinating, isn't it? Because it's also a well-known fact when you talk about climate that the Romans grew wine here. And then for, 900 years, it didn't grow anymore. And then we're back to growing it. So absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cycle, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And just at the moment, we're in a cycle where it's perfect climate for sparkling wine in particular, but still wine too. Mm. It's cool climate. They call it cool climate, which means you can make sparkling wine and certain still wines. You could never make a deep, rich Cabernet Sauvignon.
No.
Mm. I say never. You probably could in about 30 or 50 years.
Yeah.
But you can't now.
Yeah. Right. So you find this amazing piece of land, and you think, God, this is the one. We're going to go for this. It's the right shape. We like the soil. It's got the right aspect. What do you do next?
Well, you prepare the soil and you buy the vines and then you plant them.
So where do you get the vines? I mean, don't nip down to Sainsbury's to get the vines.
No.
How does that work?
Well, one of the things about the fact that the industry is new at the moment in England means that we haven't got the sort of infrastructure. We haven't got nurseries, for instance, creating all these vines for us. So the vines come from France and Germany and Italy. And a lot of the equipment that we use comes from France, where they have a well-established vineyard and viticulture industry. So our vines came from a nursery in Germany. And the tractor that came to plant the vines also came all the way from Germany, actually, to plant the vines.
So that all sounds very expensive undertaking.
It's a ridiculously expensive
undertaking. And presumably, you know, I go to the garden centre and buy some plants and stick them in my garden. I presume it's not quite that simple with vines because presumably you have to look after them in a very careful way. And I'm presuming they have to be planted in a special way.
Yeah, they have to be planted in a special way. They're planted by this machine, as I say, that comes from Germany. I mean, vines like to struggle. They don't like really good soil. They don't like too much fertilizer and that type of thing.
Really?
So in that sense...
Is that like a kind of muscle thing? That you need a bit of...
A macho plant.
Yeah, yeah. You need a bit of grief in order to motivate you to get going.
Maybe that's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you plant all these vines. We know it's going to take a long time. In general, 4 to 5 years before you...
Yeah, it takes 3 years to get the first harvest.
Right.
And then... another 2 or 3 years, depending on what type of wine you're making, to actually produce and release the wine. So yes, we bought the land in 2009, we planted in 2010, first harvest 2012, first release late 2015, so 6 years.
And bearing in mind you're a publisher by trade, planting the vines is one thing, you get these beautiful grapes. I presume you need a specialist winemaker to come in. I mean, describe what a winemaker is, because I don't think people understand... they're sort of very good at blending, aren't they, and doing all sorts of other things. So how did you find that and what do they do?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning that we have a state-of-the-art winery. Sadly, that isn't the case. I wish that it were. We have a contract winemaker who makes our wine. So we take the grapes from the vineyard downtown to a winemaker. And when you're looking for the winemaker to do that work, you look at the wine that they've made already, you look at the character they have, the amount of communication and input that you'll be able to have to the process. There are all sorts of aspects that you have to how state-of-the-art their winery is, how much equipment they use. So there's lots of different factors involved in choosing the winemaker.
It's really interesting, Paul, because we've had quite a lot of guests who've done the kitchen table thing, and then they've had demand for their product, and then they realise that they can't scale up, you know, to a big factory on their own. And we've had people like Kent Crisps, for example, who've then gone to a flavour expert to do their flavours for them.
Absolutely,
Or they've contracted somebody to do their jams or whatever it might be. But they have to be really specific about what it is that they want, how they want it to taste, how they want it to look, and go through hundreds of iterations. A lot of our guests have said, haven't they, before they go, yep, now you've nailed it. That's
absolutely
exactly what we want. And is that the same with your champagne? You're saying, I mean, for example, your normal sort of classic cuvée, you've got like a blend 65% Chardonnay, 20% Pinot Meunier, 15% Pinot Noir. Would you specify that or just start specifying the taste that you want?
You wouldn't specify the actual ratio, say, of grapes, but you would say this is the style we're looking for. It might be quite heavy on the Chardonnay. You might want it lightly oaked. You might want no oak at all. You might want an even split of the grapes. But you have to decide what style you're going for, and then you do a lot of blending trials and you taste the base wine, which is still when you're doing those blending trials.
Oh, I see. So it's not you haven't got that aeration at all.
It's not
at
sparkling
that
at that point. It's just fermented once in an open tank. And then you do the blending trial. So you have to imagine also what it's going to taste like at the end of the day after it's had the aging in the bottle.
That must be really difficult.
It's very difficult, which again is why as people new to the business, you know, we know what we wanted, but we certainly didn't think we had all the expertise to accomplish it. So we needed a winemaker to help us. So we would say to the winemaker, this is what we're looking for. What do you think? And he would take his feedback and sometimes we would say what go with whatever he said, and sometimes we might say, well, no, we think
so it's a real partnership.
Yeah, it is a partnership. Yeah.
So you've got two beautiful bottles here. I've got one with it's got a sort of a pink label, another one with a blue label, so very girl and boy there. I'm thinking one's the rosé. Have I got that right?
You have got that right.
And so what's the blend there? The thing that gives it its colour, I believe, is Pinot Noir, which is a red grape. So that tends to give it, is it colour? Have I got that?
Well, grape juice, all grape juice, whether the grapes are black or white, is clear. So Pinot Noir juice is clear, just like Chardonnay.
Okay,
is
so I've learnt something today. Thank you for that.
The colour of a wine comes from the skin.
Skin.
Not the juice inside. So in actual fact, when you're making sparkling wine in the traditional method, bottle fermentation method, you add a little bit of red wine to the final mix to give the colour that you want. So that's how you actually get the colour.
So I know it's the afternoon and it's about 20 past four.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we have a bit of cheesy tunage while we get the glasses out?
Okay.
And then when we come back from the cheesy tunage, we'll have a bit of tasting.
Because we've got Emma, our guest, and I'm sure she'd like a little taste too.
Yeah, absolutely. So shall we do that?
Okay.
Bit of cheesy tunage. Sorry about this.
Together.
Sorry about that. Bit of cheesy tunage there. Sailor, glass of champagne.
Thanks for making
Well, that's
me wait.
Lucky, isn't it?
Thanks for making me wait again for the nice bit.
Right. You've moved.
I have. I've moved next
Listener,
week.
She's got nearer to drink.
I've moved next to Graham.
I don't know why that's happened.
So, Graham, what would you recommend we start with? A little bit of white to start with?
Yes, I think we could start with the classic cuvée.
So, classic cuvée. And the correct way to pour champagne? Sorry, sparkling wine, but we call it champagne here.
just straight into the glass, any way you like.
Straw.
Well, that's fizzing very nicely. Look at that. That's the great thing. Bubbles are great.
Oh, blimey.
Perfect.
Oh, smells... I haven't actually drunk it yet. It smells quite biscuity. Am I getting that right?
Yes, yes. It has a nice biscuity smell to it. Yeah, I don't like to put words into people's mouths when they're tasting my wine. I'd usually keep quiet and see what people think.
Mm. Mm.
That sounds good.
Mm. You say something, Paul, because I need to just drink a little bit more just to see if it's okay.
You can always tell with Sue because you get a lot of
That is quite Chardonnay biased, I would suggest.
Yes, it's a blend of all three grapes, but it has got 65% Chardonnay in it, 20% Pinot Meunier, and 15% Pinot Noir.
All right.
Emma, you don't appear to have a glass.
I don't. I think I need one.
Yes, you do. Because you don't want to waste it, because you do food waste, so we don't want to waste any,
oh,
obviously.
Of course. It links in perfectly. Mm.
That's the worst excuse for finishing that bottle of sparkling wine that I've ever heard, Sue Nelson.
Can I, obviously, because it's a work-related thing, can I taste a little bit of the rosé, please?
Of course.
And how did you decide what colour to make this? I presume because you can literally adjust the colour.
You can adjust the colour, yes. So some people go for a very light pink. Some people want to go for a darker pink. We've gone for something in the middle. I'm actually very proud of the colour of our rosé. It's a shame it's radio, so you can't quite see it.
Mm. The only thing I suggest is you have to go and buy it if you want to see it.
That
and
would
it
be the answer.
It is a really lovely colour. It's almost orangey pinky.
Yes.
I know it is a rosé, but if I'd have just seen that colour pink, I would have called that rose.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks like a rose, yes. It is.
It is a delicate pink. It's a
it is,
nice
very much.
It's a refined
pink. Thank you, yes.
It looks gorgeous. Paul, will you speak so that I can, because this is radio, so that I can just taste and it's not quiet.
You want me to talk while you're scoffing all of that wine, all of that sparkling wine, that rosé. It does look fabulous. There's a lot of bubbles in it.
Well spotted.
I know. And there's no flies on me.
No, you're really, really good at drinking, aren't you, Paul?
I want to ask about the bubbles.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What is it that makes a sparkling wine sparkle versus a still wine that doesn't?
Well, the way English sparkling wine is made and the way champagne is made and the way Cabernet is made too is that it's fermented twice. Once, as I said, in a tank.
Right.
When you ferment the juice in a tank, all the CO2 that's produced in the fermentation process is allowed to escape.
And is that a natural CO2?
Yes.
Or do you add?
No, it's the reaction. When you put yeast in the grape juice,
right,
the yeast reacts with the sugar to produce alcohol and CO2.
Right, okay.
That's how you make wine. The CO2 is what is the bubbles.
It's the bubbles, yep.
So in the first fermentation, the tank is open, so the bubbles escape, the CO2 escapes,
right,
and you end up with still wine. Then, as I said before, you do the blending trials, and then you put the wine in bottle with a little bit more yeast and a little bit more sugar.
Mm.
You put the top on the bottles. The yeast then reacts with the sugar to produce more CO2, but it can't go anywhere because the bottle has got a stopper on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's where the fizz comes from. In the
Fantastic.
In the sparkling wine.
Well, this rosé is lovely. It's not too acidic for me. It's just so that's perfect. And there is just a little aftertaste, I would suggest, of the Pinot Noir. That's what you finish with. It's very nice.
Yeah, a little hint of strawberry, raspberry on the finish. Yeah.
Well, I was waiting for that because we got biscuit from the first one and I wondered what foodie comestible this was reminding you of.
He thinks that I'm just making this up. It's true though, isn't it, Graham? You get that lovely biscuity smell.
Of course you're making it up.
I'm not making it. And then there is a nice finish, which you don't always get with rosé sparkling.
Mm.
You just tend to get that acidic-y, bubbly thing. This has got a really nice finish of Pinot Noir, which is that strawberry raspberry. Mm. So I'm pretty impressed by that, Graham. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask, how popular is rosé sparkling wine these days? Is it a new phenomenon that people are buying more of it, or is it something that's always happened?
I think from what I can tell is it varies year by year, but it's getting more and more popular. In Champagne, they're making more rosé than they used to, for instance. But I mean, it just depends on the occasion, on the palate, really.
Yeah, because having admitted that I'm teetotal and I don't drink alcohol, but I watch a lot of people that do, a lot of drunk people that do.
Don't get drunk, Paul.
I wasn't looking in any particular direction. One of the things I have noticed is with still wine, that a lot of people consume a lot more rosé than they used to. Yeah. I don't know why that is, not being a drinker myself, but I just had noticed that, and I wondered if it was the same with sparkling wine.
Well, you know, things go in cycles, as we said, so I think it just seems to be popular at the moment. So, and certainly in the summertime, you do sell much more rosé than you would, say, at wintertime. It's much more of a sort of summer party.
It's very associated with celebrations, isn't it? Yeah. The pink sort of version, the rosé version. I think a lot of people are drinking champagne because they like it now, whereas before it was seen as this treat at a wedding, a funeral, a christening, as a, you know, whatever. You wouldn't have a treat actually at a funeral, would you? I don't know why I just said that, but I think people are drinking it because they like it now, as opposed to just thinking we'll have a celebration, we'll buy a bottle of champagne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is absolutely. Good. So I want to kind of move on a bit to the business side of this now. In terms of the production that you have going there in Woodchurch, how many bottles are you producing? What kind of output have you got? And where can we buy it? That's the main thing, really.
Well, we're pretty small. We're definitely what you would call a boutique producer.
Yep.
We've got 3 hectares of vines,
right?
Which at full production might make us 20,000 bottles of wine a year.
So for Sue, really.
Thank you.
We're looking
to
expand over the next few years too, but at the moment that's the situation. In terms of where you can buy it, we sell it direct from the website.
Right.
We are open by appointment at the vineyard, so people can come and buy.
So you said we can visit the vineyard.
You certainly are welcome anytime.
Cool.
And it's in quite a lot of independent wine merchants, particularly around Kent, a lot in Kent, but elsewhere too.
Okay, cool.
I was just also going to ask another business question if we've got time, and that is that there is quite a lot of competition. Mm-hmm. So you've got your bottle on a shelf next to the traditional French champagnes, and you're not allowed to call it champagne. Do you think people are being quite loyal to English sparkling winemakers at the moment? Are you finding that, or are you finding the competition a bit stiff?
I think there's a real interest, and it's growing all the time, in English wine and English sparkling wine in particular. It's a tough business because of all the competition, and obviously Champagne have been around for years and years and years, very well established brands. You need the wine merchants to really support your wine and to like your wine and push your wine.
And do in-house promotions and things like that for
and
you.
Work with them, absolutely. We're a small, as I said, boutique producer. We're not likely to be in supermarkets. We're too small for supermarkets. So we've got to rely on individual wine merchants to support us. Mm. And so far, they've been very, very helpful and supportive.
And do you do things like farmers markets and local produce markets and things like that?
Yeah, we've got our wine in farm shops we do lots of promotions and work with our suppliers.
Cool.
I mean, I would say that I do quite a lot of my food shopping in farm shops because I want to support them. And also, I just find the food is immeasurably better than being in a supermarket.
The quality of the food is fabulous. Yeah.
And I just think you've got to get your head in the mindset. So I go to Macnades in Faversham, for example, and other, you know, farmer shops around Kent. You just have to get your mindset in that I'm going to buy some great veg, I'm going to buy some great bread, but actually these places are selling really good wine now, and they're selling Kent and English wine. Mm. So I would advise anybody to go and look at that section, as well as going and getting your normal vegetables and produce.
I really do think that people have, you know, changed their attitudes in the last couple of years. Once upon a time, if you saw a bottle of wine of any description that was labelled English wine, it was a bit of a novelty and you went, oh, that's English. I'll just go and buy some French stuff, but that looks really interesting. I don't think people think about it like that anymore. I think there's quite a few brands of established English wine that are very well known now, and people will look at that. And then if they come across a boutique supplier like this, they're not going to be frightened to try it. That's the difference.
But
I think
the price thing has made quite a difference, Paul. And I think the thing with sparkling wine, which doesn't happen quite so much with still wine, is that you can make and have English sparkling wine at £25 a bottle that's as good as a champagne, but the champagne happens to be £25 a bottle as well.
Yeah.
And so there's a parity there, whereas it's still difficult to sell English white wine, I think, and English red wine because the price parity hasn't kicked in yet.
Sure.
I think.
Sure.
So, but I certainly recommend that. And the website is woodchurchwine.co.uk. And as Graham said, you can actually buy it there or go and seek it out. I would recommend it.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
So, Graham, just give us a shout for your Twitter handle or Facebook page or whichever way you want people to assault you. You don't know it. Soon
I do. It's at woodchurchwine.
Woodchurch
so nice
wine,
and easy. In fact, they've been tweeting. They're tweeting right at this moment.
Absolutely. Someone's tweeting.
He's laughing.
He's really clever. He
Graham's
can tweet
laughing.
Without moving his fingers.
I know. Graham's laughing here because he's obviously got somebody who's really good at this doing it.
My
wife, as
you've guessed, is a social media guru.
Thank goodness for that, Graham. What would you do without her? What is your wife's name?
Donna. She's called Donna.
Nice one, Donna. Well done. Yeah, you saved him there.
Thank goodness for you,
Donna. Saved him once again. You've saved him
there. Luckily, you didn't see him go red.
Yeah, it's been brilliant to talk to you and to see and Sue to sample your fantastic sparkling wine, and we wish you much success and continued success with that.
Thank you so much.
Let's kind of move on a little bit and have a bit of We Hate Heston.
Yes, and you know why we do We Hate Heston, and that's because we hate all those sort of complicated cookery programs that make you feel inadequate because you need 58 bits of equipment and, you know, you need huge amounts of space and four people to clear up afterwards. So what we try and do is we just try and showcase some really simple stuff that you can do at home that even Paul Andrews could cook.
And even me?
Even you. And this time it's mushrooms on toast. So do you want to do that?
Should we have a listen to that?
Yeah.
And I'm here. Do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Andy. I'm the sales manager from Smithy Mushrooms.
But he isn't just the sales manager from Smithy Mushrooms. He's the cooking demonstrator for Smithy's Mushroom. And he's going to show us how to cook his favourite recipe for mushrooms on toast.
Yes.
So you can hear... what do you got there?
Just a dollop of butter. Going to put some shallots, finely diced shallots, some garlic, and a little tiny, tiny bit of ginger. Fry it down, and then we're going to add the mushrooms.
So you chopped some garlic there, some fresh garlic, and I'd say that's half a teaspoon, maybe a teaspoon maximum.
Yeah, a pinch, decent, generous pinch.
A pinch of garlic.
So we're just going to brown them off a little bit.
And I love that smell of cooking onions. That always gets me going and makes me hungry.
So you brown that off a little bit. And it takes a couple of seconds. And then we'll add the mushrooms. We've got some sliced mushrooms.
So you're famous for your mushrooms. And these are shiitake mushrooms?
There's shiitake, there's aringi, there's enoki, shimeji.
So you've just got a mixed handful of these exotic mushrooms. And your mushrooms you can buy in most supermarkets, I think, can't you? And you get a packet of a mixed bunch of mushrooms.
We do. You can get just oyster shiitake, or we do a variety mixes.
Yeah, the variety mix is lovely. So you've put a whole... four handfuls of just any mushrooms you can get hold of, but please not the boring white button mushrooms that taste of nothing. So you're mixing that all in.
Yeah, so we'll give it a couple of minutes as it softens the mushrooms.
And I know, Andy, your personal favourite is shiitake mushrooms.
Yeah.
So you could, and you just do those because they're quite meaty, aren't they?
They're very versatile, but I think I like to just fry them in a bit of butter.
And you're just adding some...
just a bit of salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper. We can see those. I think it's interesting when you cook mushrooms, I find that they start to absorb the oil or the butter that you're cooking them in. And then you think, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to add some more butter or oil. But, you know, just wait, because what happens is the mushrooms absorb the oil or the butter... And then actually, as they start cooking, they then start leaching it out again, don't they?
Exactly.
And so if you hold on a little while, actually what happens is the mushroom juice and the butter or the oil starts to come out again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this is happening now, isn't it? So you start to see you're getting this lovely
reducing that
juice out. Coming in, yeah.
So you're looking to get it so it's quite soft. I mean, they will maintain a meaty texture, as it were, but...
And you're stirring those. And because you've got exotic mushrooms, we've got all sorts of different colours there, which is lovely, and all sorts of different shapes and sizes as well.
Yeah.
My mouth is watering. So that's been cooking for, what do you reckon, a couple of minutes?
Three or four minutes.
So what are you doing now? You're just adding a huge amount of double cream by the looks of it.
About 200 mil.
200 mil, that's quite chunky, isn't it?
Yeah, just the
smell is gorgeous.
Just adds that little extra, and then we're going to just add some...
loads of salt and pepper.
Some mixed herbs.
A little bit of mixed herbs.
Just to give
so
it
you've
that.
Got some fresh herbs, I'd say, you could do coriander, even rosemary, actually, can be quite nice to mushrooms. Or chopped basil.
It just adds that little bit of depth.
Yeah, sometimes a little bit of thyme, I think, is quite nice. Or marjoram. Now that is looking lovely, and the cream has gone that sort of very nice, what do you call it, stone grey colour, which is taking on all that juice from the mushrooms. My mouth is watering.
That is pretty much that.
That's pretty much that. You've added quite a lot of salt and pepper. That's important, isn't it?
Oh, yeah,
well seasoned. I'd suggest some sourdough bread, probably a pretty thick slice, toasted with some proper butter, and then just put a dollop of Andy's recipe on top. Perfect. Thank you, Andy.
No problem at all.
Cheers.
Welcome back to the Food Talk Show on channelradio.co.uk. The perfect mushrooms on toast.
Those were the lovely guys we met when we were in Birmingham NEC, and they had that great mushroom stand. You know,
the Scousers.
Smithies Mushrooms.
Yeah.
And they do these lovely exotic mushrooms, and they were cooking on the stand. So we asked them for their recipe. The smell.
They were bonkers, really weren't lovely.
They? Weren't
were
they bonkers?
They were, a bit mad, they were bonkers for mushrooms. They had every kind of mushroom you could put. They had a tree on their stand as well, didn't they?
Yeah, with mushrooms sprouting out
with
of it.
With mushrooms growing out of the tree.
Really, really nice guys. Yeah. And what an easy supper or lunch dish. You could even probably do that for a little starter if you're inviting a lady around, Paul, to your mansion.
A lady. Inviting a lady round.
To your mansion.
Do you think anyway, don't go. Don't worry about it.
So next we have Emma Rothwell from Foodminder. Mm. And this is on our innovation spotlight thing where we like to try and look at stuff that's innovative or different or new and just investigate what they're up to.
Absolutely. Really.
There's a real issue about food waste, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
It's horrendous, isn't it? I've read somewhere about food wastage in the United States or something. Apparently they waste more food per annum than the rest of the world consume.
Dearie me. Well, it's been calculated that the average UK family throws away 24 meals a month.
Blimey.
And that amounts to about £60. That's £60 a month that people are wasting on food they'd never eat. And obviously some people are on quite tight budgets. So we really need to work out, you know, why we're throwing stuff away, what it is we're throwing away. You know, are we over shopping? I suspect that's a good thing. 7 million tonnes of food and drink from our homes every year just get thrown away. And I think in one of our programmes a few weeks ago, we said, you know, a load of people are relying on food banks because they're struggling, and yet we're throwing food away, and it just doesn't make any sense.
There's no rationale behind it at all.
If we all stop wasting food, there's obviously the environmental benefits too, because if we stopped throwing all that stuff away and we were better at shopping and better at using our leftovers, the benefit
bubble
to the
planet, and squeak,
yeah, you know, all that stuff. The benefit to the planet would be the equivalent of taking 1 in 4 cars off the road. So we'd do everybody a favour.
Cool.
And I came across this Foodminder thing. I had a good old look on the website, and I'm going to get some of these. Although Emma's bought some samples, so I might snaffle those. Mm. Basically, it helps you manage your food and drink consumption, so that every time you open the fridge or freezer or cupboard, the Foodminder reminds you what you should eat first.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. That is so cool.
So, Emma, Paul in particular is not particularly good at having a fridge with stuff in it and using it.
That's edible.
So explain exactly what it is. If I can just describe, you've got a packet there. There's three round things. They almost look like bottle tops. There's a green one, a blue one, and a red one. Explain what they are. Bearing in mind this is radio, so it's quite difficult. Explain what they are and what exactly the concept is.
Well, basically, Foodminder is a visual reminder of the expiry status of your food and drink. Mm-hmm. A better way to visually describe it would be like a small disc with an LED light on, and it will flash a different colour depending on what point your food is at in its expiry process. So if it's flashing green, that means it's all right to eat, no problem. Amber is the main point that we want to concentrate on, because when it goes amber, you've got 1 day before the expiry date. So this will hopefully prompt you to either pop it in the freezer or to eat it up. And then any time after that, it's going to flash red, Red doesn't mean don't eat it. Red sort of means it's up to you.
Get on with it.
Yeah.
It means the dog's looking happy. Yeah.
So if I use this example, I go to my farm shop and I've got five things in my bag. I put them in the fridge. I've got some cheese and some fish and the potato and a banana or something. And they've obviously got different sell by dates. And say one is in 6 days' time and one is in 4 days' time, whatever. What do I do with those little round things that you've got? So what do I put on my fish, for example, if I have one of those round things?
So on the side of a food minder is a little tab which you press, you turn it on, and then you'd press it for how many days it is until the food's about to go out of date. Obviously, if it says 3 weeks, we've put in a week that you can add to.
So you kind of program it to say, you know, this banana will cease to be a banana in 8 days, kind of thing. Yeah, okay.
So you open your fridge door and I've got these on all my products and I've got in from work and I've got some are on green.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're lights, aren't they?
Yeah.
Is that right? They flash.
Yeah. So every time.
Oh, blimey! I could.
You didn't know that, did you?
I'd open my fridge door. It'll be like a disco. Oh, hey,
doubt it. There's never anything in your fridge, Paul.
so also a full element to food waste, really. Yeah. Little mini disco.
Yeah. So we've got all these products, and some have got green flashes, and some have got amber, and some have got red.
Mm-hmm.
And what that allows me to do then is I open my fridge door and go, oh, blimey, that fish is. I need to eat this by tomorrow. Because to be honest, I don't go through my fridge and keep looking at all those.
No.
Do you? I don't.
I don't know. I really don't. And being serious for a moment, which is highly unlike me, I think it's a brilliant idea because that's something that catches me out an awful lot. I eat things that I want to eat without thinking about what I've bought and what's in my fridge. And I very, very far too often eventually go to my fridge and go, I'm going to eat that. And it's already 2 weeks out of date. Because I've never got round to eating it.
Or also what Emma's saying is you only bought it yesterday, whereas there's something in your fridge that you bought 5 days ago that you actually do need to eat today, which I think is quite helpful.
Yeah.
The really helpful thing for me, though, is if it's on amber and I know, so tomorrow night, hopefully I'm going to the pub with my friends and probably eat out. If I've got something that's on amber today when I open the fridge, I know that I need to put that in the freezer. And that, for me, is what really helps the food waste, is because instead of leaving it in the fridge for too long, I can put it in the freezer and take that out later.
Precisely. Really,
I've got no room in my freezer because it's full of black pudding.
Berries black pudding we had.
It's full
on,
of berries black
we?
Pudding. I got a load of free black pudding.
Yeah.
So
how's it doing? How are you marketing this at the moment?
Oh, it's going really well at the moment. We launched back in November at a trade show, which we had great support from. Recently, we won Best Brand and Business at the FoodBev Awards in XL London, which was absolutely amazing. We were up against some really hard contestants. And we've also got the support of Shane Jordan. He's a food waste chef. He does a brilliant recipe, which people have to try, which is a banana skin curry.
Right.
So he's supporting us behind us.
Okay,
curry.
You're going to have to not move on from that. You're going to have to tell me about
that. Come on. She's not getting away with that.
So banana skin is the stuff that you eat that makes your teeth part from your gums and your lips. I got that right?
Well, I've yet to try the recipe, but definitely on my to-do list. But he's got a recipe book out. So
for banana skin curry.
It is interesting, though, isn't it? Emma's far too young for this, but my grandparents, for instance, were experts, as the whole of that generation were, in recycling or reusing food, and I made reference to a dish that we all know, bubble and squeak and things like that, but that was a very traditional dish that you ate on a Monday and a Tuesday following a Sunday roast, because it was what was left from the Sunday roast. And we're kind of reintroducing that in some respects with this product that says, hold on a minute, you need to eat this now.
Yeah.
And here's some recipes that you could include this in its present state, as it were. Yeah. Mm. Which is fabulous.
With FoodMinder, we don't want you to get to the red stage. We want you to see absolutely. It at amber and immediately think, oh, I have to eat that.
I need to use that tonight.
No one can miss, because we've got busy lives.
Or freeze it, of course. You don't have to eat it. Yeah.
One of the real problems, I think, is the buy one, get one free thing, which I personally object to.
Mm.
And what that does is it makes people buy twice as much as they need. Actually, and you know, they feel they have to take it because, in inverted commas, it's free. Although, trust me, the producer has to pay for that, and, you know, you're not getting it free. And then people get overloaded with food that they really don't need. And there is a bit of a culture of overbuying food.
Can I just state my case here? Because there's a lot of issues around this as well. Current society has changed drastically. There's a lot more single people than there used to be, a lot more people living on their own, and I'm one of them. And I go shopping. I'm a bloke. I don't enjoy going shopping very often. But the problem is...
I can't even imagine you shopping, actually. But anyway.
It's all right. Sometimes. When Sainsbury's was 24 hours, I used to go at 3 in the morning just for a laugh. But no, just being serious for a moment. The problem is I go shopping. I fill up a shopping basket. I put it in my fridge. I'm never going to eat it all in time. Yeah, but I don't want to keep going backwards and forwards to the shop. So I have this tendency to buy it all in a big pile, shove it in the fridge, and then go, oh, damn, I can't eat that, throw it all away and go shopping again. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. So mm-hmm. I'm really loving this product because it really is useful in terms of telling you what you need to do with the food, which is either eat it now or freeze it now.
Yeah, and I think another tip for me is that when you go into a farmer's shop or supermarket, always look at the sell-by date or the use-by date. Mm. And then that they'll be at the front of the shelf, the ones that have only got 2 days to go. Put your hand right back and pull the ones out the back because that will be the one that goes off in 10 days' time, and that's the one you need to buy so that you've got a bit more time.
I am good with my nose, though, as well. I don't always believe the dates on food. I'll give it a sniff. Mm. Yeah. If it smells reasonably okay, I'll eat it.
Okay, I think that's a good idea. Emma, what's the difference between sell-by and use-by dates?
Well, sell-by date is when the supermarkets can legally sell it on the shelves, whereas use-by date is something that you have to use it up by at home.
Mm. And what's best before? Is that different? I think best before is... It won't kill you if you eat it after this date, but you need to.
Yeah,
it's not a cut-off.
It's best before 2033. Yeah, but if you eat it in 2034, who cares?
Yeah, yeah. But if it says use by, then you really do have to take notice of that because that's
Yeah, but seriously, that is an issue, isn't it? Because again, it's one of those things that because there are different ways of labelling food, sell by date, use by date. Best before.
It's very confusing.
It gets confusing. Yeah. So again, you can shove things in the fridge and forget about it and not really think about it too much.
But any food scientist will say it's fine putting those things on a product, but actually if you've got a 2-hour journey in a very warm car, then that date goes out the window. Whereas if it's a cold day and
literally,
exactly, and the supermarket's around the corner from your house, then it may well last longer. Yeah. Can I just ask Graham? Does sparkling wine or champagne have a sell-by date? Does it have a natural date where it ends?
Well, the wonderful thing about champagne or sparkling wine is that it can improve with age.
Yes,
I mean we keep our wine until we think it's best to serve it. And then we release it. So when we release it, we hope that people will drink it because then they'll buy some more. But if they want to keep it, they can keep it for as long as they like.
How long could they keep a bottle of your wine and it would still be in really good condition? Because I'm sure after a certain while, I don't know, maybe 200 years or something, it peaks better.
Well, I think it would depend more on the cork rather than anything
else. This is a completely pointless question from Sue. She isn't going to keep it at all, Graham. She's just trying to pretend, mate.
When I got married, somebody bought me a champagne stopper and got married.
She's never used
28
it.
28 years ago, never come out.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
So why would it? The other thing is, how do you keep champagne if you have opened the bottle? Is it just, will it last for 24 hours and then you've had it? Or is there a way of keeping champagne a little bit longer? You've got these champagne bottle stoppers here.
Yes. I mean, we have the stoppers that you put on it. It'll last 2-3 days and still keep its fizz with those stoppers on. Yeah, no problem.
Okay, I'm just moving away. Sorry, Emma, from your topic a minute. I'll just go back to that. But if you buy champagne and it's got a cork in it, which most of them do, or sparkling wine, you need to keep it on its side, don't you?
Ideally, yes. I mean, you could keep it upright for quite a few weeks, probably months, it'd be fine. But you really should store it on its side so that the liquid touches the cork.
Yeah, and keeps the cork moist. Otherwise, you will ruin your champagne. And I remember going to some friend's house and they said, I know, let's open that champagne that somebody bought us when we got married. And they were so excited and we were very, very, very thrilled that honoured that they were going to do this. They got it out and they poured it and it was brown. And that is because they kept it standing up and, hadn't kept it on its side. So if you've got really expensive stuff and you're going to keep it for a little while, it needs to be on its side.
I'm like that. I'd go all brown if you don't keep me on my side. I tell you what, I'd like to come back to Emma. and find out about Foodminder and a little bit about the history of the product. Mm. Where did it come from? Who invented it? How did they invent it? Why they invented it? All that kind of stuff. So tell us a little bit about the background to the product.
Well, Foodminder is owned by a husband and wife duo, who idea it was. His wife one day went to the fridge, opened up the fridge and saw a packet of ham. Now, to add to confusion that we said about previously about dates, once you've opened a packet of ham, you've got roughly about 3 days before it goes out of date, and the sell-by date or whatever on the packaging doesn't count anymore.
It goes out the window, yeah.
Exactly. So she was about to feed it to the children, but then she wasn't sure when it had gone out of date, so she threw it away. And she thought, surely other people must have this problem as well. So we did some more research, and like you said, people throw away £60 worth of food a month.
Yeah.
Think about what you could do with that. It's a mini break if you times it by a year. So then from there, Foodminder was born.
Right, okay.
And what's the technology behind the product? So there's the flashing light, which I presume is fairly easy to do.
Yeah.
And what is it, a timer in a way that must sort of roll round or something so that gives you the days and then amazingly lights it up as amber or red whenever it's supposed to. That's amazing technology.
Well, it's just a simple LED light within it, yeah. And then you sort of program it similar, like you said, like a timer.
Right. Yeah.
Once your fridge or cupboard is closed, the light actually goes off.
Right,
so
okay.
The second it sees light, it starts flashing.
So it's light sensitive.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Really interesting idea. And where are you selling it at the moment?
Currently we're selling them online on our website, and we're also on Amazon.
All right. Okay.
Okay, so that's food-minder.com.
And can you wave the packaging at me? It doesn't help on the radio. Is that three in there?
Yeah, three
per packet.
I wanted to avoid the terminology of having a three pack, but you get three in that packet. What's the kind of retail cost for that?
Normally it's $9.99, right. But we've got an offer on at the moment, so the half price.
They're
so
a fiver.
Any time to buy them is now.
Right. Is it a fiver? That's
yeah,
right.
I
went on your website this morning. I think,
is that
wow,
a bog off? Is that a bog off?
Well, it would be good if it was bog off, but it's a bargain, really. If you consider how much food waste that you might have if you've got a family, to spend maybe £5, £10, £15 and getting a load of these could be a really good idea, and saving the planet at the same time.
Exactly, so. And saving your wallet.
And your wallet. How long do they last?
They've got batteries in them which last 10 months.
Right.
But obviously, because we're against waste, you can change them easily. So.
Right. You can replace the batteries, can
you?
Yeah,
they're
completely replaceable,
or else we'd be throwing away more waste and creating waste.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice.
And have you got any tips for keeping vegetables or fruit? Is there anything that doing this job where you've picked up and you've changed your habits now for your stuff and saying, I didn't realise I could do that with...
Yeah, eat
or potatoes
it.
Or whatever. You know, has it changed the way you keep food? And
yeah, definitely. And when I buy them in the supermarket, like you said previously, I always reach to the back.
Yeah.
Then I get home, I set up my Foodminder and pop it on top. And some people, if they can't be bothered setting several, I'll have a shelf where they'll all sort of go out a day at a similar time, like vegetables. So I'll put the Foodminder on the shelf, and then when it starts flashing amber, I'll know I have to eat everything within that shelf.
Very good idea indeed. Very good idea. What do you like with food waste? I mean, you say you've got a fridge full of food, but I'm not actually convinced about that, Paul.
I haven't at the moment. My fridge is absolutely empty.
Empty, apart from black pudding in the freezer.
No. The black pudding's in the freezer. I'll tell you what's in my fridge, because I looked before I came out, because I was going to have lunch, but that kind of fell apart. There is a packet of celery that went out of its sell-by date 2.5 months ago.
Oh, dear.
But I did eat a stalk. And it was okay-ish.
I can't believe that. Can you, somebody, I don't know if there's any women out there who want to take on some man who works about 500 hours a week and look after him, but he just needs looking after on the food and drink front, really.
It's the shopping that does it. That's the problem. I don't have a lifestyle that enables me to do shopping every day.
Mm.
And that's really what you need to do. If you think about it, my grandparents' generation, my gran would go shopping every day because everything was fresh. There was no refrigeration. There was no other way of doing it. She would get a dirty big bag. She would walk to the corner shop. She'd buy potatoes and vegetables and whatever and walk home. They'd eat that for a couple of meals and then she'd go shopping again.
To be fair, though, she wouldn't be working, 9 to 5 and running around with two kids. And, the modern lifestyle of a lot of women is they're doing all that and, they've got
you know, full-time jobs and
absolutely, and
children and doing all sorts of other things. So it is difficult to make that work. And I think one of the problems is going for a weekly shop. I think trying to predict what you're going to have.
That's the key thing, and that's the whole point behind this product, isn't it? Mm. Is that you buy this stuff because you impulse shop, which is what I do. I don't go with a shopping list. I walk around a shop and I go, well, that looks nice. I'll have some of that. And I have some of that. And I have some of that. And I get home and I go, I don't have a recipe for spaghetti and bananas, which is what I've just bought. Mm. So you kind of leave something on a shelf because you go, I like that, but I haven't got anything to eat that with at the moment. Mm-hmm. And then before you know it, you've forgotten it. So I really do love the concept of this product because it's going to make you think about what you're doing.
It's the order of which you eat things, isn't it?
Yeah. And even, I've said it a few times, the fact that you choose to freeze it is a great one for me because quite often I get to the point where the food has totally gone off there's no options anymore. Mm. Well, I do eat around the edges, but you know, that kind of thing.
I think one of the most useful things for me is if I get something which will last quite a long time, so say I buy some pesto sauce or something, I can keep it in my cupboard for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I open that jar, the clock's ticking, isn't it?
Precisely, yes.
And that's what's not on the sell-by date. And as you were giving that example of the ham, mm-hmm. And I would find it probably more useful for those sorts of things where, you know, I've got this lovely pesto sauce, now I've opened it, I can't remember when I opened it, so can I still eat this or can I not? You know, how long is it? And I think that's particularly useful.
FoodMinder is perfect for that type of situation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can get that on food-minder.com.
Yeah, and
Amazon. Very good idea.
And Amazon.
Go on Amazon. And I presume you just type in FoodMinder and something will
Yeah, of course. It'll come up in Google if you just typed into your Google buy.
And a really interesting website as well. There's some interesting comments on the blog and all sorts of things. And we really do need to do something about food waste.
Did somebody mention leftover recipes as well?
Oh, yeah. They're from our supporter, Shane Jordan, who has his own cookbook out.
Right.
So it might be worth a look as well.
Yeah, if you're trying to work out
what to do with your with your leftovers. Mm. Well, I've really enjoyed tasting, as you would expect, the Woodchurch sparkling wine. I'd highly recommend that. I know you're sceptical, Paul, because you don't drink, but honestly, it's really good. And particularly the rosé.
I just go by the look on your face, to be honest. That's all I need to do, really.
Yeah, particularly
and
the rosé.
And the fact that you keep looking at the bottles while you're trying to do everything else.
I'm hoping
because there is at least one glass left in the bottom of that.
I was hoping Graham might
And that's not going... I'm just warning you, Graham, you aren't going to have to take those home. That isn't going to happen.
I was hoping he might just gentlemanly leave me a little bit before he goes. So again, check that out. And that's Woodchurch Wine. .co.uk and really interesting debates about food waste and FoodMinder.
Mm. And a great sounding product and a great looking product, and I'm going to start a disco in my fridge is what I'm going to do.
I really do think you need that. Yeah.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And if you've got a family, it's because, you know, mums are really worried about safety of food and making sure they don't give their kids the wrong things at the wrong time. So that would really help, I think.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And it stopped me eating rotting celery, basically.
Disgusting.
Is there anything it doesn't work for? I mean, is there any food group that you can't use it with?
No, you can use it on absolutely anything.
Timer, isn't it?
So it's a timer. And then it's got a little sticky pad on the bottom, so you can attach it to the food as well.
All right. Okay, cool. Mm.
And you can wash them and all that sort of stuff. So it's a really clever product. And don't forget, you can use them in the cupboard, not just the fridge.
Right.
So that's all good stuff. And you've learned how to cook mushrooms on toast, Paul.
I have. I might even put... I've got to go out tonight. But if I wasn't going out tonight, so that means it's a trip to the kebab van by Tenterton Toilets. Sorry about that.
But mushrooms on toast is great.
But mushrooms on toast could be good. If I had any bread and I had any mushrooms, I would do mushrooms on toast.
But most normal people would do, though, Paul. Most normal people have
a bit
of bread, they have some butter, maybe a little bit of creme fraiche in the fridge, and they've got mushrooms, so it's a great leftover meal.
Absolutely.
There you go.
But that brings us to the end of another show. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show here on channelradio.co.uk. We will be back next week with me and the lovely Sue Nelson. But for the moment, a big thank you to Graham and Emma, and we will be back with you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.